excited to have Professor Simon Mabon with us today. He's a professor of international politics at Lancaster University, where he directs CPED, or Sectarianism Proxies and Desectarianization Project. This project is funded by Carnegie Corporation and the Henry Luce Foundation. His work falls at the intersection of Middle East studies, international relations, and international political theory. His research is situated at the interplay of sectarianism, sovereignty, and regional politics, and he has published extensively. The most recent is The Struggle for Supremacy in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia and Iran, that was published by Cambridge University Press in 2023. So that's not really the most recent. The most recent is actually this book, and you have another book coming up as well, where we will be talking about that book as well. Another book that he's published as well is Houses Built on Sand, Violence, Sectarianism, and Revolution in the Middle East. And this book was published by Manchester University Press in 2020 and was listed by Choice as an Academic Book of the Year. I've seen Simon on TV a lot. In fact, yesterday he was on TV on Al Jazeera giving interviews. So he appears on international media outlets and has discussed international affairs and Middle Eastern politics with the BBC, CNN, Al Jazeera, you name it. And yesterday was on the West Bank, I believe it was on the West Bank. So he served as academic advisor to the House of Lords International Relations Committee inquiry into the UK relations with the Middle East during the 2016 to 2017 academic year. And I will go on and on, but I have a confession to make. So I asked Simon to speak about his latest single-authored book, The Story of Sectarianism in the Modern Middle East, which is due to be published by Yale University Press in the coming months. However, in our email, we simply asked him to speak about his latest book without specifying which one, which led to the understanding that he would discuss order and region making in the Middle East. And this is based on a volume that he co-edited with Mark Lynch. That's the problem when you are so prolific, my friend. That said, Simon will also touch on his forthcoming book. So we are very fortunate to have him bringing together two important works in one talk. So you can see how I'm justifying this, which is fantastic. But without further delay, thank you so much again, Simon.
Thank you, Rehana. Thank you for the very kind introduction. It's wonderful to be here. Thank you all for coming. And Ramadan Mubarak to those of you who celebrate. I'm afraid I'm not going to talk about two books. I'm going to talk about three. And the way that I'm justifying this is to say that each one of these does a certain part for telling a story about order in the Middle East. My understanding of order, as I'm going to try and elaborate in the coming minutes, sort of tells the story of a broader jigsaw, a broader complex set of interactions. And telling the full story is a bit of a challenging task. And so my attempt to engage with this has sort of fallen across a number of different research projects. First, the book that Mark and I did, which is a little bit out of date already, as you can see from the front cover, which was very timely back in 2022-23. Then on the right, we have my forthcoming book, the one that I probably should have been talking about and misunderstood, which is coming out with Yale in May. And then the one in the middle is a sort of live bit of research. So I hope you'll bear with me while I do that. But the idea is that I will try and at least point to certain pieces of a jigsaw and highlight how they might fit together. So, sorry, I sort of undermined your initial plan. But before I get to that, I must say thank you to Rehana. invitation. It's wonderful to be here. Thank you to Jenny for all of her efforts in facilitating this and for her infinite patience dealing with me as an academic, and I'm sure many other academics who are like me as an academic. So thank you, Jenny, and thank you, Eugene, for hosting. It's wonderful to be here. Okay, so order and its discontents. This book that we did with Mark, it started out during COVID, so you can see how now it's quite out of date. Mark and I decided that we'd do something together, a joint SEPAD POMEPS project. We'd been collaborating for a while and we thought it'd be great to do something together more detailed. So we brought people together online, back when that was quite exciting, as a way of getting people together when we couldn't do anything else. And we then followed it up with a workshop in London. And this was right at the heart of Westminster, and it was a wonderful building. And we were rudely interrupted by a brass band. We went outside to see what's going on with the brass band, and the brass band was to celebrate a visit from Emir Tamim, the Qatari ruler. So we thought that was quite apt, that we're talking about regional order, and our very orderly workshop had been disrupted by a brass band to accompany the Emir of Qatar. As you'll see from this, we've got a broad range of different types of contributions, different styles of engagement with the question of order, different ways of thinking about the broad brief. And that, I think, points to some of the challenges that I've been facing in my work on regional order and what it means, and why it's taken me so many different bits of sort of research and different trajectories to get to the point of even being able to outline the different contours of pieces that come together. So we've got, as you will see, and as I'll say a little bit more in a minute, we've got sort of traditional discussions of alliances and how the states bandwagon with one another. We've got more contemporary discussions about environmental politics. We've got spatial politics. And we've got more sort of constructivist European approaches to the question of order that focus on how interactions give meaning to the very things that we're talking about. So it was quite a broad set of discussions, and it was a really interesting project to do, but it was not without its challenges. Mostly with regard to what we're even talking about when we're talking about order. It's the sort of thing that we all sort of know, right? We think we have an idea of what order is. And I was reminded when I did, when I was doing the PowerPoint for this, of a point that I made in our very first workshop. The order is kind of like the concept of terrorism. And there was a comment made by a judge about terrorism and said, look, we kind of know it when we see it. Or at least we think we know it when we see it. And I think the same thing can be said for order. We know it when we see it. Or at least we think we know it when we see it. We have a sense of what it might be. But do we really know? Do we really all have the same understanding of what order is? And I imagine if I was to turn the question to you all, we'd have very, very different understandings. Which is part of the fun, I think. And I've put two pictures on here. Two pictures that were, broadly speaking, painted, created by artists working at the same time. So this is Pierre Mondrian on the top, obviously, with a very particular understanding of order, very linear, lots of right angles, trying to depict the New York subway, of course. But then underneath, we have probably my favorite artist of all time, Ferhan Sazade, who was a Turkish artist who married into the Iraqi royal family. And I'm sure you know the story better than most, Eugene, but who, after the coup, was forced to find refuge in Jordan, where she set up an art school for women. And I thought that this sort of contrast really sets up how art at a particular moment in time can be interpreted in so very different ways. And the point can be said about order as well. So something can be orderly for one person and completely disorderly for another. And orderly or disorderly for one person and orderly for another. There's a real question of perspective here. there's a question of perspective, there's a question of subjectivity, and that kind of opens up broader intellectual questions, political questions about whose order are we talking about? Order for whom? Are we talking about a broader sense of trying to capture and describe the nature of order? Are we talking about order that is being imposed from people in positions of power? Are we talking about order that is global in nature? Are we talking about order that is then nested at a regional level? What is the interplay between those different modes of order? Because surely order at a global level and the hegemonic activity of the United States, for example, shapes regional order. But then how are we capturing this? And what is the role of the quote-unquote liberal world order in a region that does not meet many of the criteria for being liberal? So how are we understanding this dynamic interplay? And that's kind of one of the things that we're trying to look at in the book. And then we get questions of stability. Stable order is typically seen as being positive, right? But is stability really in the benefit or in the interests of everyone involved? For example, Iran, hypothetically, let's say that the Islamic Republic is able to prevent future outbreaks of unrest. It does this through violence. It creates stability, but it does that with a death toll in the tens of thousands. It creates a stable environment for those in positions of power. But is stability really in the best interest of the collective? Who does stability actually serve? There are folks in Washington who would be quite keen to say that the 1990s were a stable period for the Middle East. But it was a particular form of stability that reinforced and was shaped by the actions of the United States. It wasn't all that stable for the Iraqis who were enduring bombing campaigns or feeling the harsh realities of sanctions biting. So I think you've got to really question, what is the nature of order? Who does order actually serve? Who does stability serve? And for the book that you mentioned, Rehan, How's a Spell on Sand, I did a lot of interviews with people across the region, and an interview with an Emirati policymaker stayed with me, and it was talking about why there was no unrest in the UAE, despite the various social and economic challenges that the country faced at the time. And the argument that was made was, look, we told our citizens, we told people in the UAE, do you want to be like Syria? No. If you go to the streets, if you protest, you'll end up like Syria. So that is another argument, I guess, that stability isn't necessarily in the interests of everyone. A particular form of stability is tied to authoritarianism, for example. So we've got some very serious questions here about what regional order actually is. We've got questions about who is it beneficial for. And I guess more broadly, and there's a reference to Edwin Starr in the book that Marx smuggled in. Regional order, what is it good for? And then we've got three, broadly speaking, types of order that were shaping our understandings here. We've got the descriptive, which is an articulation of the state of play at a particular moment in time. So we're trying to capture what is happening, we're trying to describe what is going on. We're looking at the distribution of power and influence. We're looking at the particular institutions that are relevant to shaping how people, actors, are operating. We've got behavioral, the sense of looking at how people are operating, how they are acting in pursuit of a particular form of order, what the dominant institutions are, what the dominant attributes around power, the dominant norms are. And then we've got the normative. And this is where the subjectivity really comes out. How things ought to be. How regional order ought to be. And I think there's a real normativity bound up in this question of order. order for whom, and how ought it to be. And I've put here the picture from the Beijing-mediated Saudi-Iran rapprochement. And I think this was, broadly speaking, seen to be in the best interests of regional order. That the Saudis and the Iranians have been embroiled in conflict, in rivalries, in contestation for decades in lots of different ways. And so creating a mediated agreement, agreeing to normalize diplomatic relations, starting to work closer together, must be a good thing. But perhaps not for the Americans, who were frustrated that it was Beijing that was able to get this over the line. So we've got a lot of questions that start to arise here. And then we've got an interesting intellectual dynamic. And we were sitting in this room in London, and there were lots of different understandings of order, lots of different ways that people were approaching the question of what is order, from the sort of this descriptive, the behavioral, and the normative. But then there was the intellectual tensions as well, the ontological tensions, the geographical tensions, and very quickly a schism emerged in the room between the Americans and the Europeans. And as a Brit, I was grouping myself the European project one last time, or maybe not, I don't know. And it was very clear to me that there were different intellectual approaches that were being taken in terms of what is it that we're looking at, what is the unit of analysis here, what are we including when we're talking about order? Are we talking about it through a positivist lens? Are we talking about it through a post-positivist lens? Are we talking about it purely through power politics, alliance building, the distribution of power within the system? Or are we talking about it through a broader sort of constructivist approach that says, well, look, we need to look at how we're even talking about and constructing the Middle East itself. And through those processes of construction, the social constructivist approach, we're creating a sense of order. And then there were some critical approaches as well, and I would group my contribution with Eddie Wasnich into that critical camp, but I'll get onto that in a second. So there were lots of different lines of division, and it was fascinating, and really sort of highlights the schisms that emerge within IR and the IR of the Middle East in particular. So I've touched on this a little bit, but let's go into a little bit more detail about Middle Eastern order. And there's a sense that when we're talking about this, again, we all broadly have a sense of what it is that we're talking about. But those of us that teach classes on the Middle East typically start with, what is the Middle East? Which Middle East are we talking about? Why are we talking about the Middle East and not West Asia? Or Southwest Asia and North Africa? And I have very good reasons for doing that, because if you break down the acronym Southwest Asia and North Africa, you get something that sounds far too similar to my wife's name, which is incredibly confusing if I'm talking about my wife and the stuff that I'm working on. So one of the reasons why I stick to the Middle East, but the other and the more important, I think, is that I talk to friends in the region, and I ask them, where do you live? What part of the world do you live in? And they all, without hesitation, say the Middle East. Is that not a form of sort of colonialism? No, this is the region that we live in. You don't want to be called West Asia or Southwest Asia or North Africa? No, that is a neo-colonial project. Okay, so I stick to Middle East for those reasons. But the very definitional issue here starts to raise questions about order. What are the boundaries of the region? How is the region made? Which countries are we including? And conversely, which are we excluding? And there, by mentioning inclusion and exclusion, I've given my first tease to the next book. And Pinar Bilgin, about 20 years ago now, she started talking about this and saying that there are multiple Middle Easts, often overlapping, often in contestation with one another. Again, driven by questions of belonging. And so when we're dealing with these questions about order in the region, we need to even think about what region we're talking about. I was giving my third year students a lecture on their essays and essay design and the like last week. And I was asked by one student, can I do my essay on the Middle East, on Afghanistan? No. But her understanding was that she could, by virtue of some of the flows of people from Afghanistan into Iran, and the dynamics that have then emerged in Iran as a consequence of the relations with Afghanistan. It's a fair argument. But I hadn't taught Afghanistan on the course, so I said no. And I stand that. So we've got that dynamic, but then we've also got a sort of a nostalgia. We've got this nostalgia for the past, and this is where Mark's stuff, I think, is really interesting. Mark Lynch, for those of you who don't know, is based in Washington and has done a lot of work with policymakers there. And his argument that comes out in a different book about America, it's called America's Middle East, actually, is that the 1990s were heralded as this great time for regional order in the Middle East. It was this age where the US was this prime sole superpower. The demise of the Cold War created all these different opportunities. And so regional order was kind of constructed around US hegemony. And that created a form of stability. But again, going back to what I was talking about earlier, that stability was for a particular set of allies of the United States and for a particular set of policymakers in Washington. It wasn't for the people of Iraq. It wasn't for the people of Egypt, for example, or other states across the region whose rulers were key US allies. It was also a time when Al-Qaeda was starting to gain increasing influence across the region. It was a time when authoritarian regimes were gaining influence, gaining control in part through their entanglements with neoliberal capital, in part through their entanglements with the United States. And I put down here some of the key pillars of what regional order could be at this time. But I think a lot of this is up for grabs by virtue of the different definitions of order and what we think those key features of order actually are. Now, I alluded to the critical approach that I took in the book, and the chapter that I wrote with Eddie Wasnich was on normative orderings and spatial order and the way that order is created over space. One of the things that we try to do in ZEPAD is dispel this notion of proxy actors. And if you want, we can go into this in the Q&A. I'm more than happy to discuss that further. But we wanted to try and look at how influence was cultivated and generated across borders. And we looked in particular at South Lebanon and Iranian influence here. And we tried to bring in some critical approaches to discussions of order to look at the Iranian garden and Melita, and to try and see how the Islamic Republic had projected and cultivated this shared sense of influence, this sense of shared belonging, far beyond the traditional material sort of realist analysis, by virtue of transforming space. And here we drew on some of the work of Peter Berger, a legal scholar, Robert Cover, Ibn Khaldun as well, for that matter, to look at how space had been transformed and meaning had been made by virtue of spatial transformation. And here you have a replica of the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque in South Lebanon, overlooking the Israeli border, but this time with Farsi script adorning the building. So you get this real sense of meaning transformed. And in Melita, you see a lot of spatial meaning through violence and through the collective memory of a violent struggle against Israel. And we tried to look at how that meaning was cultivated through the transformation of space. And this is obviously very, very different to a traditional discussion of order that looked at military alliances and calculations of power. We wanted to look at social order and how that was formed. The other theme that we looked at in the book was, how do we understand change? What does change actually mean? How do we capture change? And there are different ways we thought of thinking about change. And one of the chapters touches on this idea of change in and change of. Are we dealing with a change in order, or are we a change of order? And it may seem like that's a subtle distinction, but we thought that it was actually quite a powerful one. Are we dealing with something that is a change within the current way of doing things? Or are we dealing with something that is more existential? A different way of organizing regional politics? Are we dealing with new aspirations, new norms? Are we dealing with different types of interactions? Are we dealing with different levels of penetration? And here I put some of the dates that Mark and I continue to go back and forward on in terms of, when did the region actually change? Are we talking about a change in order or a change of order here? And these are things that we can debate. I don't think Mark and I reached the consensus. We had a bit of an argument in the Foreign Office about this 6 months ago, about which dates we should include. But there's a consensus, I think, about a couple of them. I'll let you decide which ones the consensus forms around. So we've got 1967 and the Six-Day War, the capture of East Jerusalem, etc., etc. We've got 1979, the establishment of the Islamic Republic, the seizure of the Grand Mosque, and the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. From 1990, 1991, fall of the Soviet Union, the fall of the Berlin Wall. 2003, the US-led invasion of Iraq. 2011, the Arab uprisings. Which of these constitutes a substantive existential change in the way that regional order was done? Oh, and then, of course, we've got the 2023 Beijing-mediated Saudi-Iran agreement. Which of these constitutes something substantively different? Does that matter? I'll leave that with you. And then we get to October 7th. We get to the point that came after the book, when the book was in its proofs. And so we had to have some fights with the publishers to say, can we add X number of thousand words in the introduction and the conclusion to actually make it slightly up to date and not completely moribund? And so obviously we've seen widespread destruction. We've seen the horrors of the attacks of October 7th more broadly. Those horrible terrorist attacks. We've seen the genocidal destruction of Gaza. We've seen cancellation, question mark, of Saudi-Israeli normalization. I put a question mark there. But I was speaking to Saudis who've been involved in this, and they are very, very angry at the ways in which this has all played out. Some of them have used the term gaslighting to describe the ways in which some of the Israelis involved in these talks have been talking about the process. We've got Israeli-Iranian tensions that then erupted, of course, to the 12-day war. We've got the US strikes on Iran. We've got the destruction of Hezbollah, question mark. We've got the pager attacks. We've got the killing of Hassan Nasrallah. We've got the Iranian strike on Al Udeid in Qatar. We've got the Israeli strike on Qatar. And we've got the frictions that start to emerge on the back of that between the US and Israel. Between Qatar and the US. And I was in Doha just before Christmas for the forum, and listening to the Qatari Prime Minister talk about this, it was fascinating. The anger that is felt towards the Iranians for the attack on Al Udeid, even though the Iranians telegraphed it and said, this is not an attack on Qatar, this is an attack on the US, coordinated with the US. That is not how it was felt. Qataris are furious and remain furious. And there was an explosive panel discussion between Javad Zarif and the head of the GCC can watch online, and it's a fascinating discussion. But a lot of this starts to come out, and in coming out, a lot of the old tensions start to come out as well. But the main ire was reserved for Israel, and by extension, the United States, because of the sense that the Qataris knew about it, the Israeli strike on Doha, when the missiles were in the air. Not before. They didn't have any warning before that. And that has been a real source of contention with Doha's relationship with the United States and with Israel, of course. So, in light of all of this then, October the 7th needs to be the next date that we add to this list, I think. Again, with a question mark. Because, as the late Fred Halliday said, it's easy to say that everything has changed, or that nothing has changed. The reality is somewhere in the middle. So, I think it's perhaps a little bit too early to say exactly how much has changed, but we are certainly seeing the contours shifting. And we're seeing the spatial repercussions. I said about the book being out of date. Our chapter was certainly out of date because the Iranian garden has been destroyed, and the spatial meaning that was created has obviously taken on a new form. And then we get here. And I've spent a lot of time talking about sort of regional dynamics. And I'm hoping that you've been paying attention to the slide backgrounds. I've been talking about regional dynamics, but politics isn't just about the sort of the regional level. It's not just about systemic dynamics. It's also affecting the local, the national. And this is what I'm trying to get at in this book here. And it was a book that tried to sum up the decades worth of work that I've been doing on sectarianism through the Carnegie Grant and through various other things. And it sets out to try and tell the story of sectarianism in the modern Middle East. It does that by looking at five different cases. Two of them are obvious, two of them are less obvious, and a fifth one is a little bit surprising. So we have in the book a discussion of sectarianism in its sort of academic style. What is it? What are we dealing with? How do we understand sectarianism? And I try and guide the reader through that, the different approaches, the different questions that need to be asked. And through that, I managed to get in that I'm a Yorkshireman living in Lancashire, which is complex. It's made more complex by every May there being what's called Roses Weekend, which is where the universities of Lancaster and York play out the Wars of the Roses in sporting format. And that leaves me in a bit of a bind, because that leaves me living in Lancashire, ostensibly supporting the county of my home against the county of my birth. And I struggle with that. But that kind of gets at the heart of a lot of the questions of identity that I want to be dealing with in the book. I also managed to get in that I'm an Arsenal fan, and amongst other things. So a little tease for the opening chapter there. But in it, I sort of work through the various approaches that have been used. Morten Fallbjorn's work, Fanar Haddad's work, Toby Matthiessen's work, Rima Majed's work, Melanie Kame's work. There's obviously a huge amount. And I think there's something more to be said more generally. And I try and look at some of the non-Middle Eastern work that has been done on sectarianism. And my uncle was formerly of this parish. He was a professor of New Testament theology. And his first book, called Christian Origins, looks at Christianity as a sect of Judaism. And so it's quite interesting to go back to some of that stuff and to look at sectarianism in a slightly different light. And I think there's really interesting things that come out of that. There's some really interesting stuff coming out of India on sectarianism. Secular sectarianism by a chap called A.J. Gudavatri. There's interesting stuff coming out of the US politically, not even looking at religion. And so it gets me to this point where I define sectarianism as a process of setting life apart from within for political ends. And that allows us to go into some interesting discussions around meaning, around identity, around the instrumentalization of identity without going down those pure instrumentalist routes. And I'm happy to discuss this further in the Q&A should you wish. But the book looks at, beyond the conceptual discussion, it looks at five chapters. It looks at Iraq and Lebanon, for obvious examples that are often discussed in debates on sectarianism. I then look at Saudi Arabia and Iran, because I think they're important given the geopolitical significance of the two states, but also given the domestic dynamics of Saudi as a Wahhabi state in the past, quote unquote, that's undergone dramatic transformation in recent years under Mohammed bin Salman. This reintegration of Shia Muslims, the marginalization, if you will, of the hardline Wahhabi ulema. And then Iran with its complex religious and ethnic makeup, telling interesting stories about the nature of belonging in modern day Iran. And then the chapter that I personally found most interesting, because it wasn't something that I'd written a great deal on, but one that might get me in a little bit of trouble intellectually, is Israel, Jewish sectarianism, which I thought was a really interesting way of looking at some of the tensions that start to come to the fore in modern day Israel, particularly questions about the relationship between particular parts of the religious right and the state, between particular parts of the Zionist movement or Zionists and the state. And if you think about sectarianism as this process of setting apart from within for political ends, then I think it can shed some interesting light on the internal machinations that are playing out within Israel today. But I think when we're talking about order, we also need to be thinking about some of these internal machinations. So we've seen, I think, in recent decades, the global affecting the regional and the local, all these things playing out in lots of different ways, and of course affecting the nature of belonging. And I think fundamentally sectarianism is about inclusion and exclusion, questions of who belongs and who does not belong, and the ability to articulate that. And there I'm drawing on the work of Hannah Arendt in particular, just to complicate this intellectual project even more. Processes of inclusion and exclusion, I think, are key, but they are products of time and space. They are shaped by the complexities and contingencies of the social worlds, the political worlds that people inhabit. And I think if we look at the past 50 years across the region, we're seeing local politics increasingly influenced by and shaped by those regional dynamics. Of course, 1979 is the obvious example. Expressions of solidarity across the region with what was happening in Iran. In 2003, and the years afterwards, following the US-led invasion of Iraq, we start to see expressions of sectarian solidarity in Bahrain, for example, with Sunnis in Iraq who were facing marginalization and oppression and violence as the situation in Iraq deteriorated. In 2011, cross-regional solidarity, expressions of solidarity, etc., etc., etc. As the global financial conditions deteriorate, as anger increases in Lebanon and Iraq, for example, 2019, we start to see people taking to the streets in Lebanon, taking to the streets of Iraq, in part influenced by and influencing each other. Kelonien, Kailon, Nurid Watan, we want a homeland, all of them means all of them. Cross-sectarian protests. Now, of course, there are some strange things that happen after that. COVID happens, takes the wind out of the sails. the elections that eventually happen return the very people that the protesters had been demonstrating against. So you get these strange things starting to happen, influenced by domestic, regional, and global dynamics, of course. And I think another really good example of this is what happened post October 7. And if you talk to people in Lebanon, or indeed across many other places, I spent a lot of time talking with people in Lebanon about their views on what was happening. And there were some people who were very, very anti-Hezbollah, who were starting to take on softer views towards Hezbollah, who were starting to be more supportive of Hezbollah by virtue of their opposition to what was happening in Gaza. These were not necessarily just people from the Shia community, but Sunnis as well. So you start to see these reimaginings of social relations, a reimagining of what it means to belong, reimagining those lines of inclusion and exclusion. And I've put here a photo that was taken a couple of months ago from the south of Lebanon of Sunni and Shia clerics praying together, respectfully. I thought it's a beautiful moment. Lebanon, a state beset by sectarian cleavages, sectarian conflict. So we're starting to see this reimagining, not necessarily always in a positive light, but there is scope to reimagine, I think, by virtue of the changes that are happening regionally and globally. And here we get to the third part. Sorry, this is a bit of a whistle-stop tour, but I couldn't do this without using this overused quote from Gramsci. The crisis consists precisely in the fact that the old is dying and the new cannot be born. And it strikes me we are in an interregnum. And if I go back to a rather amusing moment, we were in Beirut a good number of years ago now, and this was another POMEP SEPAD event, and we had a good group of us there. Mark Lynch was there, I was there, Basal Salouk was there, Toby Dodge was there, and if there was ever an example of the clash intellectually of US and UK / European approaches, it was when Basal was talking about Gramsci, Toby was talking about Bourdieu, and I was talking about Agamben, and Mark was sitting in a corner shaking. But I think this captures the mood right now. We're in an interregnum. And yet, I think by pointing that out, I'm sort of saying the book that we've done raised interesting points and important points, but it may be that we need to consign it to the past, that it's a history book, not a book of international relations, because things are changing. The region was already in flux. The region was already on the cusp of something new, this transition away from a reliance on oil, a move towards the visions projects, if you want to call them that. Gulf states articulating their futures away from a reliance on oil. We'd started to see this generational leadership transformation, transitions. We'd see new models of regional security bringing the Iranians into the discussions. We'd seen new economic models starting to come to the fore. We'd seen NEOM, we'd seen all these wonderful visions of the future that were emblematic of tension between tradition and modernity, between what is, what was, and what could be. Starting to see reimagining of social contracts. We're seeing new efforts to impose a form of order. Transformations of the very way of life. Transformations in the way that life was organized. Now, of course, some of them have been scaled back. NEOM, in particular, the line, scaled back dramatically by virtue of a lot of the things that have been happening. But there are structural changes. There are new modes of doing politics that are starting to emerge. And I think that can be seen with the waning influence, if we want to call it that, of the quote-unquote liberal world order. New models starting to emerge, The Board of Peace met today, for example. A rival to the United Nations, perhaps? New ways of doing politics starting to emerge. And I think these are perhaps some of the increasingly common patterns. And here I'm alluding to some of the stuff that I'm doing for the next project, which is looking at bringing sovereignty into some of these discussions, and in particular, sovereign economic zones. Now, I've noticed a bit of a pattern here, and this is very live research, so please bear with me. But I think that there's a pattern starting to emerge where the zone is being positioned as a technique of ordering, a technique of security, or a new way of doing politics. And I've put here on the top, you can see something from Trump's 20-point plan. I'm hoping that you can just about read that. And he references a special economic zone. The rest of the plan sets out the role to be played by experts, the role to be played by wealthy states. Doesn't really say much about Gazans, strangely. Then we have an Israeli-Syrian ski resort. Again, creating a zone. Not really talking about the people who are living there, but using this idea of a zone to try and improve political relations. And I mean, there's some deeply problematic ideas here that are bound up in quote-unquote liberal peace and democratization theses and things like that. But the basic idea that he seems to be drawing on is you create these spaces, you mark out these spaces that are then with designated to be special zones with limited regulation, limited political oversight, beneficial taxation, designed to allow people to generate wealth as quickly as they possibly can. There's a big sort of fingerprint of Peter Thiel here. A lot of his work starts to feed into it, unsurprisingly. And then we start to see Lebanon as well. Lebanon's also a US-backed economic zone. Well, there's been lots of rumors about this as a way of trying to move past Hezbollah, generating capital, generating jobs, not necessarily protecting people, but relying on money as a form of creating stability, security, dare I say, order. Now, if you look at what Trump is doing in Ukraine as well, there is talk of a Ukrainian special economic zone. So there is certainly a pattern that is emerging. And in all of those patterns, people are forgotten. I've put this image on the bottom just because it was crude, crass, and I think sums up a lot of this. And this is where I'm going to end. I'm ending on a blank slide, deliberately. And I said earlier, I hope you've been paying attention to the backgrounds of the slides. I've got a couple of things to say. NEOM has been built on land in Saudi Arabia that was home to indigenous tribes. Members of the Al-Hawaiti tribe who lived there have been arrested, sentenced to death on terrorism charges for resisting the transformation of their homes, for resisting the transformative project. NEOM has been designed as a vision of order for the future. For the Al-Hawaiti, not so orderly. What do changes in order do for people? It has a dramatic impact on people in lots of different ways. We all know the dynamics of the transformation of Gaza and what that will mean for the people of Gaza. Or we don't, depending on your interpretation of that. But the reason for ending on this, and the reason for using this is a piece of work done by a friend of mine, an Egyptian artist by the name of Mariam Mabrouk. and it's called Hanged. And I think it's a very visceral way of capturing the role of people, the role of agency, in all of the different machinations of political life. And if I go right the way back to the very start, there was a nod to this. This is another piece by Marion. And you can see what she's done is she's drawn a map and she's inverted the map. And she's inverted the map. And she's tried to capture the various entanglements of contemporary politics across the region. And then you can see some white figures. She's tried to remind us that politics, in the spirit of Ibn Khaldun, is fundamentally about people. It's about the survival of the species. And I think this is something that is all too often forgotten when we're talking about politics, when we're talking about regional politics, and when we're talking about order. And I'll leave it there. Thank you very much.